Shalom le Yehudim, shalom le Bnei Noach, shalom le Goyim. It's the evening of the fourth day, Yud Be'iyar, Tav Shinayin Hey, Parashas Emor, the evening of the third day, Tuesday, 28 April 2015, webcasting from the Hellenistic state of Israel. Well, the top story here today was not surprisingly the Israeli effort to rescue the Israelis stranded in Nepal, caught in that humongous earthquake on Shabbos. Two jumbo jets and three smaller planes carrying some 250 rescue personnel and tons of equipment took off yesterday. There have been isolated telephone conversations from Nepal with the media that we've heard. Trouble is, roads are impassable there. It's also not a country with a surplus of helicopters to rent or buy. The embassy in Kathmandu has surely been doing everything it can. The foreign ministry here estimates 650 Israelis in the country when the quake hit. More than 200 of them have already been ushered onto those planes and back to Israel. By late afternoon today, it was reported that now only 50 have not been accounted for. There have been reports of rescues of Israelis trapped in various towns and in the wild. Some rescuers got hold of a 4x4 and made it to one such isolated group who were desperate one moment and then instantaneously elated when they saw this vehicle coming into view and guys jumping out speaking Hebrew, shades of Entebbe. Unfortunately, among all the reports on those in Nepal who finally could contact their families back in Israel and of the tears shed by the families during these joyous phone calls, there's also an unhealthy focus in the reportage on rescuing babies, those in the arms of Israeli sodomites who go to Nepal to find surrogate mothers. These men were desperate because they had no milk for the infants. And of course, as Moshe Feiglin pointed out today, no breasts to nurse the babies. It turns out this has become a fashion among some sodomites that go to Nepal, where one of them plays the role of the husband and presumably stimulates himself and hands the seed over to a woman who impregnates herself one way or the other. And then after 9 months, the couple comes back to fetch the newborn. Now, I am as tolerant as the next guy. Two adults want to act out a fantasy of being husband and wife. Who is to stop them? But don't ask me to bless the behavior. And when it comes to this fashion of creating a baby this way and raising the baby in their fantasy world, I draw the line. I think it should be illegal. The de-Judaized anonymous editorialist in the Jerusalem Post today, on the contrary, pontificated, quote, "The right of parenthood should be self-evident, regardless of one's sexual orientation, inclinations, or lifestyle," close quote. First of all, the concept of sexual orientation is a complete lie. There's no such thing, because it implies that there's more than one when there is not. The anorexic woman does not have a different nutritional orientation, and likewise sex, the activity, is plainly about creating another human being. It's the act of procreation. It completes with the involuntary ejaculation of seed from the male of the species into the female of the species, seed programmed to seek out an egg to mate with and create more human life. That it is also an extraordinarily pleasurable activity is nonetheless not its central purpose, but fleeting moments of pleasure versus the creation of another human being who gets born and needs two loving parents, one male, one female. And preferably, the female is the one who gave birth to the newborn. I think it's functionally criminal that men are being allowed all over the moribund West to do this. I think it's a form of child abuse. An infant needs to nurse at his mommy's breast. The benefits of that are well known, and no rubber nipple on a bottle can substitute for the real thing. I think there is a madness loose in the world. A couple of weeks ago, the U.S. Marine Corps reported that all the female candidates in their infantry officer course flunked out. Though I think the importance of the story here, of this experiment, is less the failure of the women to equal the men in physical feats, the very idea of running the experiment at all. What did they expect? What, it's news among the descendants of Adam and Eve in our generation that men are physically stronger than women? That they had to run this experiment at all speaks volumes about Western culture in its decadent phase. There's also something deeply meaningful and symbolic in the news of former USA Olympic decathlon champion Bruce Jenner exposing himself as really a woman underneath. And in recent months or years, he has been, as they say, transitioning and becoming who he really is inside, which is a woman. And I say, this is madness that people are thinking and speaking this way. A woman is a womb man, and no man in history has ever been transformed, has ever transitioned into being a woman. No male has ever been fitted with a working womb, and fallopian tubes, ovaries, the whole nine yards. In fact, I have never heard even one of these so-called transgender males say, I'm really a woman underneath, and what I really want to do is have a baby. I want to nurse the baby. I want to feed the baby. I want to bathe the baby. Tickle the baby. In a nutshell, the so-called transgender male hasn't got a clue as to what it means to be a woman. What he wants is something else. To be a hermaphrodite. To be both sexes at the same time and have sex with himself 24/7. So it was disheartening in the coverage of the disaster in Nepal here. This emphasis, to my mind, on criminal behavior in the guise of mercy and compassion. This child abuse committed by Israelis, by Jews. I also was disheartened to read of a meeting in the States last week between some Orthodox rabbis and the pro-sodomite camp in search of a way to be more inclusive of this community in Orthodox Judaism. No one deserves to be abused and persecuted for his addiction, which is what I think all sexual perversion is. Like heroin, like cigarettes, only much more powerful. But to my way of thinking, there's a country mile separating tolerance, on the one hand, from approval, and from denial that homosexuality is not a mental disorder. So it was cataloged in the professional literature before the 1970s, and since then I have seen no evidence to show why it was right to declassify it as a mental disorder. I once got stuck in traffic in New York trying to go crosstown on Gay Pride Day. Most Sundays in the year in Manhattan, you can see a parade down Fifth Avenue for one ethnic group or cause or another. And that Sunday, it turned out to be Gay Pride Parade Day, and so the police regulated traffic as usual. They let the marchers march for a couple of minutes and then halt the parade to let the crosstown traffic proceed. So I get stopped at the corner and witness this parade, and what I saw was pathological behavior, grown men prancing around in women's underwear, writhing atop floats, gyrating to their canned music. It was a carnival of sexuality on display, having nothing to do with making babies and raising healthy children to be good citizens. On display was a parade of self-stimulating hedonists, from the Greek word for pleasure. On the political front, our usual beat, I imagine you all saw Wendy Sherman, Undersecretary of State, threaten Israel on Monday, and not for the first time, with a knife in the back if we don't kowtow to the wishes of her master, the Imam, in the Oval Office. Sherman, remember, is, by academic training, a social worker, a profession not known for its tough-mindedness, and so it's no wonder that when she presided 20 years ago, 1994, over the negotiations with North Korea over its nuclear ambitions under President Clinton, that turned out to be a fiasco of incompetence. But never mind. She had heart, what Robespierre during the French Revolution called the proper virtu, the proper philosophic temperament. In his day, during the Terror, a politician without the proper virtu would be sent to the guillotine by him. Sherman, of course, does not have that power, but she remains in charge of the nuclear negotiations with Iran over its nuclear ambitions. Heaven help us. Anyway, she addressed a gathering of so-called Reform Jews, who I know from personal experience haven't got a clue as to what it means to be a Jew for real, and thus their views of Israel are commonly all mixed up with what's fashionable inside the Beltway, where political philosophy is dominated by the old-line white Anglo-Saxon Protestant aristocracy. For the entire stable of State Department court Jews, Aaron David Miller, Richard Haass, Danny Kurtzer, Martin Indyk, their role model for a statesman is James Addison Baker III, famous for his F the Jews crack, famous for accepting LTF's insulting idea of addressing the Senate Foreign Affairs Committee and sneering that when Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir of Israel wants peace, here's the White House phone number. And then he read it out slowly, one number at a time. So there was a Wendy Sherman meeting fellow Democrats of Jewish extraction to tell them, and of course the world, that if the new coalition that Prime Minister Netanyahu puts together does not pursue the two-state solution, as the Prime Minister indicated he would not on election eve last month, well, then the tradition of the United States shielding Israel from world anti-Jewry in the Security Council at the UN is no longer to be depended on. In other words, if the Security Council wants to cripple Israel with the kinds of sanctions slapped on apartheid South Africa that brought down that regime, the Obama regime won't stop them. Israel has to, in other words, ignore its own analysis of its fight for survival and instead pledge allegiance to the two-state solution. And what is the two-state solution? On the very same day, 13 September 1993, when the Oslo Abomination documents were signed with such fanfare on the White House lawn, Hanan Ashrawi of the PLO Murder Syndicate said on television that no peace was possible so long as even one settler remains. And that has been PLO policy ever since. So the two-state solution in Arab eyes, and those of world anti-Jewry like the EU, who support the Arabs, means the complete evacuation of all Jewish communities in Judea and Samaria, and according to the Arabs, the Jewish quarter in Jerusalem no less. We're talking about some 500,000 Jews whom the enlightened expect to see driven from their homes and forced to live somewhere else. It means turning over all their homes and their schools and synagogues, hundreds of them, that surely will be turned into either mosques or stables. It means handing over all the nice roads that Israel built and paid for, all the electrical infrastructure, the telephone lines, the cell phone towers, medical clinics. The two-state solution, according to Wendy Sherman, would mean the expulsion of more Jews from their homes than were driven from Spain in the summer of 1492. Abandoning the hills of Judea and Samaria, the Jews would also be handing over the high ground overlooking tiny Israel's coastal plain and its one international airport. This is what Bibi Netanyahu should be supporting, according to Wendy Sherman and her superiors John Kerry and Barack Obama. You maybe saw as well news of the annual Washington, D.C. journalist dinner last week where Sultan Barack Hussein made a joke of Prime Minister Netanyahu wanting to attend his funeral. And I say, this is projection. Obama's implying Bibi wants to see him dead, when it's Obama who wants to see Bibi dead and Bibi's country in ruins. Muslims like him cannot abide the existence of Israel. Black Jew hatred burns very bright in some quarters in that community, Without Jew hatred, no one would ever have heard of Louis Farrakhan. What did he ever do or say of importance besides his public outbursts of classical Jew hatred? Like Reverend Jeremiah Wright, who preaches not God bless America, but God damn America. And for 20 years, Barack Obama sat and listened to that man's sermons and even honored him with the expression, The Audacity of Hope, for the title of his illegal book. And I say illegal because Obama was given an advance by a publisher to write about the state of black America and instead wrote his autobiography, which included numerous episodes of dubious veracity. That is who Barack Obama is, and one can only hope that there are people in Washington who understand his virtual obsession with Israel. Keep in mind his serial insults of Prime Minister Netanyahu, and to be on guard against his malevolence against the Jewish state, which is par for the course for a Muslim. Yesterday, Wendy Sherman warned her audience of post-Jews that if the new government steps back from a commitment to the two-state solution, which is, quote, something a vast majority of Jews support, that will make America's job of standing up for Israel internationally tougher, close quote. In this, she was basically giving these people their marching orders. They were told that the vast majority of American Jews support the two-state solution, which expresses their loyalty to their president as American citizens who do not want to be accused of dual loyalty. Back Bibi against Obama was her subliminal message, and you are disloyal to your fellow Americans. Above all, where it is really disgusting here big time, is that Obama, Kerry, Sherman all demand this complete insult to the people of Israel who voted for Bibi. Israel is a democracy, and by their ballots, the people made clear Bibi is to be their preferred leader. But here is Obama, Kerry, Sherman, and company thinking they know better what is best for the state of Israel than the voters in Israel. Obama's years, you see, as a community organizer in Chicago and then state senator in Springfield, whenever he showed up, gave him a far greater understanding of Israel and our neighbors. He knows the region and our conflict better than Netanyahu and all of his backers as well. It is his disrespect for the Jewish people in Israel. That's monumental here, and yet another abomination in Obama's time in office. You're listening to www.deprogramprogram.com, broadcasting from the hills of Judea. I'm Shai Ben-Tekoa. Continuing with this latest threat from Obama via Wendy Sherman, Steve Rosen, formerly of AIPAC, wrote, I think on the Gatestone site it was, wrote of Robert Malley. He's the hardest left of all the State Department Jew boys, probably the most de-Judaized of them all. He's Obama's director of Middle East policy on the National Security Council, and he was reported to be telling last week at least one European nation that basically what Sherman said, the administration is prepared to abandon the decades-long policy of protecting Israel at the UN in favor of a French proposal being drafted that holds high the banner of the two-state solution. And in this regard, as well, Rosen cited French Foreign Minister Laurent Fabius, who says the purpose of this resolution is, quote, pressure from the international community to dictate clear parameters for a negotiated solution which will conclude in 24 months, close quote. Talk about diplomatic double talk. He wants to dictate a negotiated solution. But if it's dictated by the international community, it will not be negotiated by the two parties, will it? And in Rosen's piece, I could not help but note the coincidence that both Malley and Fabius are radically de-Judaized Jews. How so many of the players in our lives here in Israel are either pro-Jew or anti-Jew Jews. It's like Jews arguing among themselves and the Goyim taking sides. Malley is a case. His father was an Egyptian Jew whose role models seem to have been French intellectuals of the hard left. And in fact, for some years, he edited in Paris a magazine on Africa, its economics and politics, from a typically Euro-left position. His mother is a piece of work, a New York Jewess in the employ of the Algerian FLN delegation at the UN. That's the role model for the PLO. When Robert was born in 1963, in the 1950s, as my book reports, the war in Algeria against France was the fashionable war among the international left, what Vietnam would become in the 1960s and 70s for America. And apparently, Barbara Silverstein of New York was a lefty and enamored of these conscienceless Marxist-Leninist brutes when she went to work for them in the year following Algerian independence and admittance to the UN as a member state. It's virtually certain then that Robert, son of these two, was exposed to no Jewishness whatsoever. And as for Laurent Fabius, well, he was born in Paris to two Jews, mother and father, who had converted to Catholicism and raised him in the church. And one can only imagine with that history what his childhood was like. For such boys, their Jewish background is a humiliation. How interesting that Israel has to do battle with anti-Jew Jews such as these. In a way, the international argument over Israel is Goyim choosing sides, which Jews to support, the pro-Jew Jews or the anti-Jew Jews, like Malley, who, like Sherman, threatens to abandon Israel to the malevolence of the Security Council, potentially lethal malevolence, doing to Israel what was done to apartheid South Africa, cripple it economically. God forbid. Finally, on the violence scoreboard, yesterday a firebomb hit a Jew-driven pickup truck in the tribal land of Benjamin, north of Jerusalem, and the truck was totally engulfed in flames, though the Jew behind the wheel was able to escape unharmed. There was also a firebombing of a bus on Route 443, the alternate Jerusalem-Tel Aviv highway. Fortunately, the bus was empty, save for the driver, who also got out in time. I guess it's just more of the daily, weekly eruptions of homicidal violence by these Arabs, whose soulmates in Baltimore, Maryland, the last 2 days have been on TV screens around the world via their throwing of firebombs and rocks at police and looting and arson, deliberate attempts of murder of police, sending some to the hospital. Such violent types, I think, should never, ever be listened to, either in Baltimore or Jerusalem. Their complaints are simply excuses to justify their primeval urges. In Baltimore, we are told the rioters are protesting the killing of one of their own in police custody, and I say every one of them who looted a store did not give a damn for that dead boy or to protest police brutality. Not one of them. These are just the lowest of the low. Everyone who attacked a cop was not motivated by their allegedly racist behavior, but just because these are antisocial types who hate all authority and must be dealt with mercilessly. I could not help but notice as well the similarity between the terrible rioting in Baltimore and what our police and soldiers are subject to by rock-throwing, Molotov cocktail-throwing brutes. How interesting as well that in the reign of King Barak, who was promised to be the first post-racial resident president, the relations between the races have not been this bad since the 1960s. Obama is a destroyer, a force for evil. Laila Tov, Me'eretz Yisrael.